Across the UK, across the continental United States, and around the world on the internet, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you, as I always say, for returning to this show, and this time round, very exciting, I am in Johannesburg, South Africa. I am not sitting in London, I am 6,000 miles, 10,000 kilometres south from New York City, if that's where you are listening to this show. That's about 8,000 miles away, I think, south. Long way away from home, in a different time zone, in a different climate. This is winter, but it feels like summer here to me anyway, coming from the Northern Hemisphere. So that's what I'm doing, meeting some of the people down here in South Africa who don't get, perhaps, as much play up north as they ought. Now, this show, have to say, is now reaching more and more places around this world. Recent interest I've had from Stockholm, Cologne, Madrid, San Jose, New York City back again, Adelaide, Jakarta, and so many more places. Emails coming in from around the world all the time. Thank you so much for those. If you'd like to email the show, then it's unexplainedhh@yahoo.co.uk. unexplainedhh@yahoo.co.uk. And I won't bore you too much with this. Just to say again, like I say every time, if you listen to the show on iTunes or from our new FeedBurner feed, please go to the website as well, put a hit on the website and drop me a quick email. It's always good to know that you're there. Had some great emails over the last month or so making suggestions for the show. I'm going to follow up on all of those. And like I say, feedback is terribly important for this. Right now, I am sitting in an apartment in what was described, I think, in a magazine that I recently read as the richest square mile of Africa. This is Sandton in Johannesburg, which is a kind of posh suburb here. A lot of multinational companies are sited here, finance companies. There's a huge shopping centre. And it is amazing. It really typifies the contrast that you see in Africa, because here you see the wealth of Africa and you don't have to drive too many miles away from here to see the complete opposite side of the coin. But that is one of the great things about Africa, because all human life literally is here. And it's funny I should say that, because the person I'm talking to is sort of talking about human life too. Cut a long story short, a few weeks ago I took myself down to Stonehenge. I just felt that I had to be around those stones. And whatever you might believe, wherever you are, you pick up a kind of peace and awe from those stones. I don't know what it is, because we don't fully understand what the stones were there for. A lot of people have theories about it, about how they channel the rays of the sun into a particular point there, which of course they do, but nobody's totally sure what it was for, or whether it was there on its own, or whether it was part of a chain or network of stones around the world, which is now what people are coming to believe. I'm in the home of Michael Tellinger, anyway, who is described on his book jackets as an export author. I love that phrase, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Howard. It's nice to be talking to you, and welcome to all the listeners that are listening to this around the world.
How do I describe you then? What are you, apart from being, according to your book jacket, a leading export author?
That's a tough one. I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I graduated as a pharmacist with a Bachelor of Pharmacy degree from Wits University. I've been interested in human origins. I've been actively involved in the arts as a musician and an actor. I've produced television shows and written screenplays and had radio shows, and I've done a lot of things in my life, and mostly my interest has been in the scientific, and I'm always curious and incredibly keen to scratch and discover more about human origins. That has really, since I was the age of 14, has driven me, and I've been most passionate about that, to try and find the origins of our human ancestry.
So look, was there a point for you when you produced the TV shows and did all the things that you did? Was there a kind of turning on a light point where you said, okay, I have to now do this for a living and become an author and write about this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And that happened about 7 years ago. And obviously I've read a lot of literature and done my own kind of research into the subject of humankind and the origins of humankind. But at the same time, I was also looking more at it from a scientific perspective, because of my science background and qualification. I started questioning more and more the genetic dilemma that we face as a species, and the fact that this gene pool suddenly appeared on this planet Earth any time between 170 to 350,000 years ago. And it got to a point where I could no longer have discussions across the table consuming large amounts of wine with, you know, drunken friends that get more and more abusive as you start trying to explain to them that these things don't really make sense. And when you start putting your theories on the table, not necessarily just theories, but scientific fact, often they met with things like, oh, what kind of rubbish? I've never heard of that. You know, so suddenly they start having a scientific argument with you with an answer like, I've never heard of that. And that becomes the basis of a scientific rebuttal. Yeah.
It is bizarre, isn't it? There seems to be this great black hole in science. And suddenly we appear as we are at a point, and then all of history is all of history as we know it and is documented. But for a lot of us, it doesn't really add up. How can we just appear like that?
Well, exactly. And as I was saying, so when you have these debates with people, it suddenly dawned on me, you can't have these debates with people that are not necessarily correctly informed, because they have their own opinions and their own, if I may say so, often skewed perception, which has been drummed into our heads as a society by religious leaders, by historians that are also not necessarily always too bright, by the education system that, you know, David Icke talks about, the left brain prisoners, and so we go. So I realize that to get across this information, I need to actually put it down and write a book about it so that I can string this storyline in a simple to understand story about the human race from beginning to where we are today. And I found that there isn't really such a book. In all the literature and all the books I've read, they deal with all different aspects and different elements of this. Either it's genetic, or it's the reptilians, or it's the bloody ETs, or it's the or it's the different agendas, but there isn't one book, or the Sumerian tablets and the ancient history and so forth. But there isn't really one book that takes all this information and strings it together and tells you a story of how all these pieces of the puzzle fit together. And that's really what I set out to do.
Well, in my head, there's this kind of template that mankind, a distant relative of ours, started here in Africa.
Yeah.
But then the rest of the story, the torch was carried on, you know, up north and in places where I'm familiar with, in America and in the UK and across Europe and out towards the east. And Africa really didn't have a whole lot much else to do with it.
That's quite correct. And we have very clear and overwhelming genetic evidence for that argument. You know, the whole mitochondrial Eve, where suddenly humans appeared and this is where they appeared. We call it the cradle of humankind. I suppose that terminology has now been accepted globally. And we are sitting right in the middle of the cradle of humankind. This morning we spoke about the Melville copies, where there's evidence of humans 200,000 years ago. And that is staggering. Not far from the Sterkfontein Caves, where we have Mrs. Pless or Pless and Littlefoot and other hominids that are 3.5 to 5 million years old.
Well, let's just explain that this was a conversation we had earlier today, setting up this conversation that we're having now in your lovely apartment. But we said that there is a place called Melville Copies here in Johannesburg, yeah. And the official story around it is it all dates back to one period not very long ago, but there is evidence under the noses of people who go there that actually that's not the whole story.
Correct. You've got to understand that South Africa is going through a very interesting political period right now, and there's a whole lot of political entitlement going on. And it's almost like, you know, we're now in power. I'm talking about the black government. We're now in power, and we want a little bit of payback. And that's, you know, it's fine. I don't have a problem with it. And most so-called white South Africans don't really have a problem with that, because they realize that, yeah, there needs to be some reparation going on. But if you start doing that at the expense of withholding historical information and evidence that is much bigger than a very short lived political agenda, then I have a problem with that.
So you saying things are being, this almost sounds like apartheid, are being censored. Absolutely. That information's being censored.
Absolutely. And I can tell you why I say that, just in case people are skeptical about this. We have what we refer to as these historic sites in South Africa where archaeologists go and dig. Now, when they find a skeleton and they dig the skeleton out, then suddenly the local community all get up in arms and they say, hold on, you can't do this. This is our sacred burial ground, and we've been burying our dead here for the last 400 years, and you may no longer dig any further. And that's it. It stops right there. Now, if that happened in Egypt, we wouldn't have discovered anything if that kind of attitude was promoted around the world. Archaeology is not a science that should be driven by an agenda or an emotional outburst of one group who lays claim to a particular site. These people that are making this noise are latecomers, relative latecomers to this particular part of the world.
But if they say we've got burial grounds there and we maybe live there now, they've got rights too, haven't they?
Of course they got rights, but they weren't the first people there. We have clear evidence that this was the cradle of humankind, and that, you know, 250,000 years ago there were already humans living here.
Interesting debate to have. You tell me that because they weren't the first people there, they don't have rights to say what they think should be done with the land that is there now?
Absolutely.
They don't have rights to have.
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, if anyone has rights, it should be the original people that lived here. And those are the Khoisan people. And no one gives the Khoisan people any rights. They've been pushed into a bloody reserve. Yeah. They're almost extinct. No one gives a damn about the Khoisan people. And they were the original people that lived here. We have beautiful Bushman paintings throughout the caves of Southern Africa. Everyone comes and marvels about these early humans that did all this amazing stuff. But when it comes to rights, bang, there's no rights for those people.
So you can actually cite now specific examples of where people have come forward and said, you can't dig there, you can't explore there, because this is our land, we have rights, and actually that's not true,
There are two very good examples, and one is a very well-known site called Mabungubwe in the Limpopo province, and which is directly linked to the Great Zimbabwe Ruins. That's where they found the golden rhino and some very interesting golden jewelry and golden artifacts, and then they stopped because it was deemed to be an ancestral burial ground for the local Bantu people. Okay, because we're talking about the Bantu people that came down to Southern Africa in the 1200s, 1300s, and so they're relative latecomers. You know, by the 1200s and 1300s, the European and Asian and South American civilizations were thousands of years old. Okay, the civilization in South Africa was even older. But those were the Khoisan. That was the Khoisan civilization. And therein lies the very interesting story that we are now about to expose to the rest of the world.
Okay, well, let's just finish out on this little detour that we've taken now. Because there will be people, and I'm sure this is not what you mean, but who will say what you just said about saying these people don't have rights to say don't dig here. It sounds kind of racist. I'm sure that's not how you mean it.
Of course it's not racist. I mean, I don't give a damn who you know, I don't care if it's your grandmother who says who's buried there, or if it's my grandmother. I can't come and tell archaeologists, sorry, you can't dig any further. Although we know that there's another 10 meters of sediment down there, and civilizations that date back 200,000 years, but because we've discovered one layer of civilization, now we may no longer dig. I have a serious problem with that.
So what do you think motivates those people who stop the exploration? What, apart from this is our culture, this is our heritage, do you think there's more to it?
You know, there's been a lot of stuff, a lot of issues raised in South Africa with land claims. Okay, and this is a very hot potato. And, you know, I don't mind putting my foot right into the middle of it and let the people fight this out, argue this out, because, you know, land claims in this country have become a very sensitive issue, and we don't really want to go the way Zimbabwe has gone, because that's not going to get us very far. So over and over we have the situation where these ancestors are laying claim to so-called land that is theirs, and then later we discover that this land was actually given to them by the Zulu chief or the Khoza king or the Sutu king a long time ago. But somehow that gets shoved aside, and they no longer have any rights. So, you know, although it was given to you, you know, no longer have rights to this land. I know I'm making it sound really simple, and I'm simplifying it. However, if we're going to start talking about land claims, then let's talk about who were the original people here. The original people were the Khoisan people. We can't really find any other evidence of earlier civilizations here. And as I said before, no one has ever discussed the rights of the Khoisan people and what land claims they have and they can bring forth.
And who represents them then? Who's going to represent their interests, do you think?
As far as I know, they do have some representatives. I mean, this is not really my area of expertise. Oh. It's just something I have a really huge gripe with. And you know, and then when people start talking to me about land claims, I get quite heated, and I say, hey, listen, it's, you know, just because you must also remember that, you know, the Portuguese and the Dutch arrived here 150 to 200 years after the Bantu people arrived here. And they have no rights to this land whatsoever. If this was the case in Europe, can you imagine there would be a war every 10 years? Because you know, European land and American land has changed hands all the time. Well, mainly European land and Near Eastern land has changed hands so many times. There'd be a war every 10 years. Somebody trying to lay claim to something that, you know, their ancestors, and then those ancestors, it'll never stop.
Well, I guess one of the things life teaches you over years of bitter experience is that you have to deal with situations as they are. And I guess this is the situation South Africa finds itself in. You're trying to further the cause of knowledge, so you just have to kind of work with things as they are. I suppose frustrating though it may be, yeah?
Yeah, you know, what worries me though, and this is a real worry, and what I said much earlier is that the historians that work for the universities in South Africa, and now I'm really rubbing their nose in it, many of the historians that work for the universities will not do anything that will jeopardize their jobs. Remember, they're getting paid by the government. So if they start making a noise that goes against the grain of so-called Bantu entitlement, and that there were civilizations here before the Bantus tribes moved here from Northwest Africa. If they start making those kind of noises, they're not really very popular with the regime. And that's how I see it. I might be completely wrong, but there is enough evidence to support what I'm saying now. And I'd rather move on because now we're getting into a political
and
debate.
And it seems
that's
to be
not the issue.
Well, the only thing that impacts on me, you know, as a guy coming down from London, is that it's a shame that politics has to rear its ugly head in even this.
Absolutely, and that makes me so angry. And I've, unfortunately, because of the kind of research I'm doing now and the books I'm writing about it, I've been faced with it almost on a daily basis, and I'm sick of it.
Okay, well, look, let's get on and talk about the subject of the new book and why, according to the posters that are going to be appearing with this new book, which is out in July, why it is so groundbreaking, you think?
It's exactly what I mentioned, these early humans. It is now commonly accepted by scholars, historians, archaeologists that the cradle of humankind is in Southern Africa. We are sitting right in the middle of it, as we said earlier. Melville Kopjes is right up the road here. We have clear evidence of humans living there 200,000 years ago. Down the road, we have the Sterkfontein Caves. We are surrounded by fascinating artifacts that take us back to an early, early human civilization, 200,000 years ago to 70,000 years ago, 80,000 years ago, the Blombos beads found at the Blombos Cave, the Khoisan beads in the Western Cape, and the Bushman paintings and all the caves around Southern Africa, and there are thousands of these caves. When you start putting this together, you realize that there was this rich human civilization and a lot of people that lived here between 200,000 years ago and about 75,000, 60 to 60,000 years ago. And then suddenly they packed up and moved north. And this was the whole big exodus out of Africa into the rest of the world, out of which the whole world was supposed to have been populated. And that's fascinating. And then suddenly, so from 60,000 years ago till 1200 AD, there seems to be this black void of nothingness in Southern Africa. And historians are telling us in a roundabout way that we don't really have much of a human history in that period. And that is very unfortunate because we have clearly an ongoing and a rich human history that goes back to from 75,000 years ago until the arrival and the resettlement of Southern Africa, or the cradle of humankind, when the Bantu people eventually came back to Southern Africa. And they came back as different people. They left here as, we believe, Khoisan people, and they came back as different, evolved, genetically mutated, whatever you want to call them. And they came back to resettle Southern Africa. And within there, we have a phenomenal wealth of new discoveries that we've made in ancient stone ruins that until very recently, for political purposes, now it comes back to that, for political purposes and political reasons, have been called cattle kraal, built by the Bantu people as far back as maybe 13, 14, 1500 AD. And therein lies the problem.
So you're saying that these things, and we'll get on to what they are, I want you to tell me what they are, you think, are not just cattle pens. They're much more than that, much older than that.
Of course, they're much older than that. They're much more than that. I mean, we've documented these over with the help of people like Johan Heine, who's been photographing them from the air, from aeroplane, beautiful aerial shots. And it's only really from the air that you can start realizing what it is you're looking at. It is spectacular. And you will see a lot of those. I'll show you photographs of these. I have several thousand of them for our books we'll be publishing. Not only that, when you start analyzing these circular stone structures and these ruins, you realize that the architects of these were far brighter and more attuned with the cosmos, with the orientation of planet Earth, and also had a very keen knowledge of geometry. They are very fine geometric principles built into many of these structures. We have links to some of these being structures being linked to the rise of Orion and the stars of Orion, which suddenly gives us an indication that the architects of some of these sites were possibly the progenitors or the early architects of the pyramids of Giza, the pyramids of Mexico, and also the pyramids of China, because they also linked to the rise of Orion's belt. And this is phenomenal. So we're looking at some humongously old structures here. As we've dated Adam's calendar, discovered by Johan Heine, this sort of Stonehenge kind of complex of monoliths that are aligned with the solstices, the sunrise, equinoxes. We've dated this to about 75,000 years.
I was going to say, you know, speaking as a Brit in South Africa now, what does this mean for our, you know, beloved Stonehenge? We all love Stonehenge in the UK. Where does it leave us?
It leaves you to understand where the people that most likely built Stonehenge originated from. They left here some 70, 60,000 years ago. They moved north, and from the knowledge that they applied here already a long, long time ago, they then continued applying that knowledge and building similar structures like Stonehenge in the Northern Hemisphere. But when you actually look at, I know you had a quick glance at the book, but when you look at the book in great detail and you see the way the stones and monoliths were constructed, you realize this is a really old structure. It is because of its raw and basic form, and it just predates at this stage any other man-made structure found on Earth.
Well, the story of Stonehenge, as I know it, is that these massive rocks were brought somehow from a couple of hundred and something miles away, hauled all the way there, and then erected on this site in Wiltshire, you know, near Salisbury, on the plain there overlooking the sun as it rises and all the rest of it. Is this story a similar story to that story? Were there feats of that kind performed here?
Absolutely. We had the top geologist in South Africa who knows that the Mpumalanga area better than anybody else. We took him up there, Dion Brandt, Dr. Dion Brandt, and he couldn't believe it. I mean, he has surveyed that whole area so well, but when he saw this, he just, you know, he marveled at what happened here, because the bedrock that you're looking at is what's referred to as Black Reef Quartzite. And that is really the edge of the escarpment, where the Transvaal escarpment ends. It's referred to as the Transvaal escarpment.
Well, having been to Mpumalanga, the one thing that struck me, and years ago I studied geology and I wasn't very good at it, but the thought that came into my head is that this must be a very ancient landscape, because a lot of the hills and little mountains, they're not really mountains, but the hills there, are very rounded. They've been weathered, and they've had time to weather, so it's a very ancient landscape. So if things were done there back then, that was a good place to do them.
Exactly, and you put your finger right on it. It is. We have among the oldest mountain ranges in the world right here in South Africa. And but what's interesting about this calendar site, which we now call Adam's Calendar, because it is the oldest man-made site found on Earth to date, according to our research, what we find there is that the rock that is used for the monoliths is not the same as the bedrock. The bedrock is Black Reef Quartzite. The monoliths are dolerite. The dolerite, the closest area where the dolerite could have been obtained is about between 2 and 5 kilometers away from the site. There is also things like soil shift. Over thousands of years, you can see the monoliths tilting and leaning towards the edge of the cliff. Some of them that were originally placed on the edge of the cliff to mark the rise of the sun and to mark the rise of Orion's belt just before sunrise, those monoliths have subsequently fallen over because the soil shift has pushed them right over the edge of the mountain. Fortunately, they haven't tumbled down into the valley, and we can see where they originally would have stood. And with re-engineering or reverse engineering the site, doesn't take a genius to do that. You take one look at that and you'll see this was originally a circular structure, and from the surveyor's drawings it is very clear, and that was surveyed to the millimeter, how accurately this was put together along many thousands of years ago.
Well, the question they ask about Stonehenge, and the dumb question I'm going to ask now, is if those stones were transported 5, 6 kilometers, 10 kilometers, whatever, how did they do it? And they didn't have a JCB or a truck or something to stick it on. How did they load them on and move them out? If you see what I'm saying?
No, you're posing a very important question, and this is a question that many conspiracy theorists, I suppose, or alternative authors have dealt with. And we start that really brings us into a whole another debate as to the origins of humankind, because there are some very sinister activities that have taken place.
Well, let's ask the question then. Were they helped by, as we, some of us think, up north in Stonehenge, were they helped by some power over and above this earth?
No, absolutely. I mean, it is a more and more accepted belief that Earth has been visited by advanced beings for millions of years, and that these beings have settled this planet at various times in our history, and also mainly believe that we, the Homo sapiens, are a cloned species for specific purposes, and therefore it becomes easier to understand how these ancient civilizations could have moved such giant rocks, especially when you get to the pyramids or the ruins in Baalbek, northeast Lebanon. Those giant blocks that weigh over 1,000 tons each. And these people seem to have moved these with relative ease that we cannot fathom how they did that. And we just sort of push it aside and write it off and figure out, well, they somehow moved it.
You're right. Up north, we've come to accept it. We just accept it. We don't quite know how it happens, but it was just one of those things they did. Exactly. But you're saying that happened here too.
Exactly. Look, these monoliths we're talking about are not nearly as big. We are actually talking about smaller rocks that weigh between sort of 2 and 5 tons, but they're still large rocks. You know, I challenge any normal person, put away a 4x4, come on top of the mountain with your toolbox, and I'll want you to move that 3-ton rock over there from 2 kilometers away to this site here, place it perfectly in line with a vernal equinox sunrise, and I want you to carve out half of it so that the other side of it can also be used for different elements of the setting sun. And then when you finished, 5 or 10 years later, call me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you can do it with a computer and some heavy lifting gear today, but how would you do it then? Unless somebody helped you, helped you.
And this is where we now really start wrestling with the true origins of humankind. Who is this weird species that we belong to? This Homo sapien species that suddenly emerged 250,000 years ago or so and took control of this planet. But let me say very quickly, those first 200,000 years were not pleasant. And the two common denominators that I found, and if you read Slave Species of God, my first book, it deals very extensively with those early turbulent days of humankind. The two common denominators that you, actually there are three common denominators that you can find in all of human history is, first of all, our absolute obsession with gold. You cannot separate humankind from the obsession with gold. And even in the biblical scriptures, in Genesis 2, it already states that God loved gold so much that he took Adam and Eve to the land to the Garden of Eden, where the river ran through and there was gold.
Well, South Africa is still to this day gold country, but correct. Was that the case back in this period that you're talking about?
Yes, you see, now you start stringing the pieces of the puzzle together. Because humankind, it seems, was firstly cloned to become this slave species to dig for gold for a higher group of beings. And we were cloned as a slave race of gold diggers. This planet, it seems like this planet was originally settled as a mining planet and a mining colony. And guess what? We are still a mining colony and a mining planet. There is more stuff being mined today than ever before.
That's really heavy stuff to say. But if you think about what we're talking about here today, we're talking about expeditions to the moon to get what they've got up there, and to Mars to maybe mine what they've got there too.
Correct.
So if you extrapolate that backwards to the past, then it doesn't take a great big stretch of your mind to say, well, maybe this is what happened then.
Yeah. Now, I'd like to spin you another little something to think about, right? The nature of science and the nature of quantum physics is that everything in the universe spins, right? Atoms spin, molecules in your body, everything vibrates and spins. The solar systems spin, the galaxies spin, the universe spins. The distortion in space-time, the one thing that Einstein didn't get right is the distortion in space-time actually creates a spin, and that creates the spin and the vortex effect of all things in space, right down from the universal to the subatomic particles. There's one thing that we look at every day that doesn't spin, and that is the moon. And that poses a lot of very fundamentally hard questions for us to deal with. What is the moon really? How did it get there? Remember, we have no absolute answers about our moon. It is a huge dilemma.
Well, it's a whole other subject, but I know, and you probably know, people who say that the moon is actually hollow and there are things being kept inside it, or on the dark side of the moon there are things that are in stasis, they're asleep waiting to be woken, and all sorts of crazy theories. Maybe not so crazy about the moon and what it's there for. Yeah. What do you think?
No, they're not crazy at all, because if you start looking at our human origins, the moon played a very important part in the settlement of our planet, and the movement of these early settlers on planet Earth, the movement between the moon, Mars, and Earth.
So you're saying that the moon was maybe a staging post?
Correct.
Back in those days,
yes.
For whatever was coming here?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a staging post. It was also a springboard to get stuff off planet Earth. So ask yourself this question, and I deal with this in Slave Species of God very extensively, is what happened to all the gold that we've mined on planet Earth? If you add up the amount of gold that we've mined, okay, there's not enough storage space in all the vaults to hold this gold. And then you start looking at the Sumerian tablets and what they tell us, how this gold was removed from planet Earth by the early settlers who then created humankind, the Anunnaki, and so forth. And you start realizing that there's a huge cover-up here going on with gold. First of all, why have we been so obsessed with gold? Certainly not to dig it out of the ground, crush the ore, and then hang the stuff around our necks. Okay, that is not a good enough answer. And that's what historians tell you. When you ask them, why are humans so attracted to gold? No, it was the allure and the shiny allure and that attracted humans to hang it around their necks. I say, oh, what kind of crap are you talking about? Please wake up, smell the roses. There's a much bigger agenda going on here.
But what do you think that agenda was then? Somebody out there needed gold for a reason that we cannot understand.
No, we understand it very well. And this information is spreading rapidly now because we now starting to understand that not only gold but the other platinum group metals have an ability to exist in a monoatomic state. Okay? And now we start getting into advanced quantum physics and advanced and yet very simple scientific facts that many scientists are very familiar with. But as you said earlier, this information does not make the 8 o'clock news. Mm-mm. Okay, very basically, gold and other platinum group metals, platinum, rubinium, palladium, iridium, have all got the capacity or the ability to live in or exist in a monoatomic state. Gold was obviously the preferred one by the early settlers on planet Earth. Their obsession with gold was not about the gold in its raw form that we know it as, the shiny thing that we put on our fingers and hang around our necks. That's the diatomic state of gold, the monoatomic state in which it loses all its metallic properties. It becomes a white powder. And this white powder has some phenomenal properties. Most importantly, it basically acts as a superconductor. It gives off a white single frequency of light when when charged with a tiny, tiny amount of energy, it retains that energy, and it makes everything around it within a specific area proportionate to the amount of white powder of gold. It makes everything free of gravity. And now we get into a whole new scientific
line. So they're using it as a fuel. Maybe.
Correct.
Right.
So we're now starting to understand that the gold was really a fuel device, an energy device, and so forth. It is also quite possible that the Ark of the Covenant was filled with this white powder of gold. When you start reading in the Bible the properties that the Ark of the Covenant had, it is difficult not to believe that it actually was white powder of gold because of the simple descriptions. Moses comes down from the mountain with these clay tablets. He sees they built a golden calf. He takes the golden calf, he burns it in the fire, he turns it into white powder. Excuse me? When you burn gold in the fire, it doesn't turn to white powder. So, you see, there are little telltales in the biblical scriptures and in many other religious scriptures throughout human history that if you start putting the pieces of the puzzle together, they suddenly jump out like a sore thumb, and they go, my God, what's going on here? How come we've missed this before? They burn the gold, turn it into the golden calf, turn it into white powder, then he puts it in the water and he makes the Israelites drink it, because the healing properties of white powder of gold have now been well documented by a group of scientists around the world.
Well, that's very strange you should say that. I had a guest on the radio version of this show, and some people listening to this might well remember. Guy who came in, and he said, I'm here to talk about one thing. He was here to talk about crop circles. Okay, but he said, I've also got this. He said, I found this stuff, and it was a little file of liquid white powder gold. And he said, you see those gray hairs you've got there? He said, notice I haven't got any, and I'm older than you. He said, well, that's the reason for that, and that's cured a lot of my ills. And I thought, you're mad. Maybe he wasn't so mad.
No, he wasn't so mad. And fortunately, we have some really interesting recent human activity that points towards this knowledge having surfaced already relatively recently, and then being squashed by the powers that are trying to, the Illuminati and the controlling global controlling groups that were trying to, their best to keep this kind of advanced knowledge away from the main global population.
So how does all this dynamite stuff that you're talking about now tie back into the subject of this book and the wonderful photographs that you have in it of these ancient, very, very ancient sites? How does that all tie in?
It all ties in because of gold. Gold is the common denominator. And I mentioned earlier the three common denominators. Let me quickly mention them because we keep jumping around. So it's gold. Second one is slavery. Okay? Humans have practiced slavery for as far back as we can possibly go. Even God condones slavery. He tells you how to treat your slaves, that when you may kill your slaves and when you should not kill your slaves. You know, what kind of rubbish is that? Come on, wake up, people. And then the third one is that all ancient civilizations throughout Africa, throughout the Americas, throughout Asia, their creator God is always referred to as the flying serpent, or the winged serpent, or the feathered serpent, or something to do with a winged flying serpent. When you look at ancient rituals by American Indians or Native North Americans and South American and even Asian tribes, whenever you see a feather in a ritual, in African rituals, whenever you see a feather in their rituals, it goes all the way back to the original so-called mythology. It is not mythology, but let's just call it mythology, of the feathered serpent, the winged serpent being the creator God. Every time you see a feather, they don't even know that that's what it actually refers to, but it ultimately goes back to the feathered serpent as the creator God in all ancient human civilizations.
So
the link is gold, three common denominators: gold, slavery, and the same creator of all ancient humans. And the only obvious conclusion we can reach here is that early humans were on this planet to mine for gold. And here we are in southern Africa, in the so-called cradle of humankind, where most of the gold in the world has ever been mined, and it continues today. And this is where they started mining gold. 250,000 years ago already, they were mining gold.
So the story of this country is a great big circle.
Exactly.
Comes all the way back around again.
Exactly.
For different reasons, but it's the same thing. So what does that mean? I went to visit a great place called Maropeng. I'm probably pronouncing that really badly, which is not very far from Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be the story of ancient man right up to today. And it's got lots of lovely interactive displays and wonderful pictures there and sculptures and all the rest of it. And it's a great tourist, you know, great tourist experience.
Yeah.
I came back with Disneyland.
Exactly.
Yeah, I came back with a T-shirt and a mug from there.
I'm embarrassed about Maropeng. You know, we heard so much about this here that they're putting this wonderful, you know, origins of humankind centered together. It's going to be, and when I went there, I was so disappointed and so embarrassed, and I really don't want to blow it for them, but guys, they didn't think this
through. But they've spent a small fortune there, and they get tourists now from America and UK and everywhere going to that place. They love it, but you're going to tell them now, you're telling them now, that's all wrong.
It is wrong. That is not the real cradle of humankind. There is not a single human skeleton ever found near there. Okay, that is called that should be called the cradle of hominid kind. Hominids is that we have found there. Like I said, Mrs. Pless, Littlefoot. Those aren't Homo sapiens. Those are other hominids. There's Homo erectus, Homo australopithecus, and so forth. And
so the word is, hey guys, there's a big part of your story missing, and actually you're in the wrong place anyway.
Yes. Where we have evidence of early humans is in Mpumalanga. Actually, all over Southern Africa, with a Khoisan, evidence of Khoisan people living everywhere. But where we have evidence of their dwellings, their workplaces, their temples, their shrines, their burial, not their burial, their possible sacrificial sites, we still yet to find skeletons and evidence there when we start digging. But we have probably close to 20,000 stone ruins that formed an ancient civilization that was so vast that they could have actually probably been as many as 3 million people living at some stage. Now, this is where it becomes really interesting. Let's get back to the gold. We have overwhelming evidence that there were people mining gold 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. Okay, loads of gold was mined here in Southern Africa. The richest gold mine in the world today is still called Sheba Gold Mine. And where is it? It's in Nelspruit. I'm not in Nelspruit, in Barberton. In Barberton, close to Nelspruit, in Mpumalanga. And so now we start tracking back the human history, the obsession with gold, the mining of gold, these ancient huge settlements of ancient stone ruins that give us clear indication that there were lots of people living here mining for gold. We have found many ancient gold mines, so old that they're completely covered up by soil. And so it goes. And now you start looking at how history and biblical events start to cross over. And here we have this character called King Solomon, about 1,000 or 900 BC. And King Solomon was a gluttonous bugger, and he wanted gold. What he needed the gold for, we don't quite know. Some people link him to be the top grandmaster of the secret societies on earth and so forth, but you know, let's ignore that for now. But here's King Solomon, who amassed the most amount of gold of any person in recent human history. And he had this concubine called Queen Sheba, who lived in a mystical or mythical place called the Land of Ophir. Now, no one's ever been able to find this place. So you got to ask yourself a question. If 1,000 years before Christ, there was this guy who amassed all this gold, where was, or is there a place on earth that there was gold being mined at such large quantities? And the answer to that is a resounding yes. We have found that. We have found the civilizations. We have found the ruined evidence of this huge human settlement, 1,000 BC, 2,000 BC. Remember that gold, these guys must have been digging that gold for quite some time already, because they had a lot of it. Because this guy used to export like a ton of gold every month, or whatever it was, to Jerusalem. So whoever was digging this gold must have been doing this for a while. And the only place on earth that could have happened was here in Southern Africa.
And you're talking about a massive trade on the scale of the trades that we do today.
Correct.
Huge.
So what we're saying to your listeners is that we have not only discovered the oldest man-made structure on earth, 75,000 years old, maybe older, Adam's calendar, but we've also most likely uncovered what was King Solomon's mines.
That's incredible. It really is. Now, the problem with, I mean, this is all great news for you. I mean, you're going to sell a lot of books on the back of this, we hope. But this place is going to be invaded by people wanting to see it.
Correct.
Not good news.
Well, this is why I'm part of this foundation called the Makomati Foundation, and you can go online and check this out, look at some of the photographs, makomati.com, I think, or .co.za. Makomati. By the way, Makomati is an ancient Dravidian term. They were Indian miners at 2,500 BC already. At the beginning, basically, as far when the great Indus Valley civilization was just starting to boom, those Indian traders or Dravidian, not Dravidian, they came later, but there were already Indian miners here mining for gold. And those are the guys that eventually then, you know, started feeding the gold to King Solomon and taking a lot of it back to India. Remember, India consumes more gold than any other country in the world, even today. And it seems like that was the case then already.
I mean, it sounds incredible, and it's going to raise a lot of eyebrows. A lot of people are going to love this way of explaining it all. But there are an awful lot of people who are employed, like you say, as scientists and maybe in government-funded posts, who are going to say, this is garbage.
Well, you know, unfortunately, there's overwhelming evidence. I don't just say this because I feel like saying it. I say it because I can back it up.
So what happens now? What do we do with this knowledge?
Well, we are starting to develop the tourism routes to these sites. From helicopter flips to hikes to 4x4s to horse rides to a diverse number of ways that people can get to these sites. Most of them are on private farms. So what we've started doing under the Makomati Foundation is getting all the farmers to stand together under the Makomati Foundation's umbrella, and from there we control we control it from a central point.
So these things are on farmland. Now, what I do know about South African farmers, having known this country for quite a few years, is, you know, they tend to be fairly tough, fairly down-to-earth guys. Mm. They are. They have to be.
Yeah. Well, I did a presentation to a farmers association on Saturday morning, and let me tell you, the guys responded with such enthusiasm. They became like little children, these big, tough guys that became like giggling little kids.
So you got them on side, which is good.
Totally. No, they
love about the government, though? That's your next thing.
I must tell you that right now, I suspect that our biggest enemy here is most likely our government, because they, and I say this carefully, because we have some allies that we've made and people that are sensitive to this, but if the government doesn't treat this the way it should be, and if they start putting party political agenda before a much greater global agenda, we're going to have a problem here, because we're dealing with something. We discovered Egypt here in Southern Africa. I mean, with thousands and thousands of ancient stone ruins, this should become a global attraction, and we should get an extra 10 million tourists a year to come and see these.
Great news for South Africa, but what South Africa has to be able to do is to get people in safety themselves, easily, into Mpumalanga is a beautiful, beautiful place to see anyway. Even if we didn't know this, it's a great place. You want to get them in safety, easily, and get them out again without damaging what they've come to see, without ruining it.
Correct. And again, I have to stress, this is why the foundation is so important. So on our website, we're going to be... the government isn't going to give us anything. We've already applied for government funding, and they're just ignoring us. We're persona non grata right now, because we are telling the rest of the world that there is something much older than the so-called Bantu civilization. And they don't like that, you know, and it's a huge problem. Huge problem.
And we have to say...
Do you understand why I started with...
Totally, absolutely. Now it comes... I mean, the best storytellers start with a point, and then they'll bring you back to that point, and you understand what it's all about. I understand what you're saying, but, you know, politics and race are going to rear their heads in this thing, because people are going to say, well, you know, you're undermining the empowerment of the black civilization of South Africa.
I don't think we're undermining anything. I think we're actually bringing attention and developing new business opportunities and empowerment opportunities for people in rural areas, and especially in Mpumalanga, to get involved in this tourism huge monster that's going to be created around these ancient sites.
And all you're saying to them is... we must get our story straight.
Exactly.
Not your story, our story straight.
Let's get South Africa's and the origins of humankind story. You keep promoting the cradle of humankind. Well, where is this cradle of humankind? We have now presented the cradle of humankind to the rest of the world. And with that comes a huge responsibility to stop lying, to stop fooling yourself, stop having this feeling of entitlement, and start seeing the bigger picture, and start... allowing people with ability and knowledge to put these pieces together. Because in the last 10, 15 years, unfortunately, we've seen over and over again of incompetent people being put in charge of very important areas and they screw it up. And when it's too late, unfortunately, it's too late. When we destroy and desecrate these ancient ruins, we can't fix them. I'm sitting with a situation right now when one of the most important farms with over 200 of these ruins is there's an attempt to expropriate it to build low-cost housing on.
And how close is that to happening?
Well, the farmer is being forced to sell the land so they can build shacks on or low-cost housing.
So you're going to lose it?
Well, we're going to do the best we can not to, because I think that's happening because of ignorance. The town council doesn't know what's actually happening. And we need to just bring them into the light and explain to them what is actually happening. We've been working on this for 5 years.
This is a South African. This is a South African situation, seems to me. I mean, you see this in many places, but you kind of need, I don't know, what do you think? We need international help on this.
We need serious international help. We need World Heritage Site intervention and huge money, because if we don't, without, you know, with just me publishing a book about it, creating awareness, the gluttony of unscrupulous South African government officials might override all this goodwill. And they are those kind of individuals.
Talking to you reminds me of a lot of old movies that I used to see about English public school boys, and they go up before the headmaster and the headmaster would say, well, my boy, you've got a lot of explaining to do. It seems to me that as your book comes out and in this next month and as this year goes by, you've got a lot of explaining to do too. You've got to put this case out there.
Yeah, well, I don't mind explaining until I'm blue in the face, because this is very important, and it's not important to me. It's important for the future cultural heritage of the whole of Southern Africa. Zimbabwe is full of these ruins as well. It looks like Great Zimbabwe ruins was actually the headquarters of all these this ancient civilization. And there's an interesting thing in the Sumerian tablets. Also remember that Zimbabwe ruins, they are probably about 3 or 4 levels below it. What we see now is just a recent construction on top of ancient sites.
So the Zimbabwe stuff may be older.
Much older. Mm. No, Zimbabwe stuff is
much older.
Several hundred thousand years old. Okay, several hundred thousand years old. The current structure on there was probably built around 1100 AD, maybe between 500 and 1100 AD. That has sort of been agreed on. But from the really credible geological resource, archaeological information that I get, is that there are several civilizations that have lived there before. And it's interesting because a so-called winged serpent or feathered serpent, the creator and progenitor of all mankind, settled in Southern Africa according to the Sumerian tablets, and he set up his abode from where he ran the mining operations in Southern Africa. And that abode was near the gushing waters by the lake. And if you look at how that terrain would have looked 200,000 years ago near Great Zimbabwe, it would have been pretty much the kind of environment that the Sumerian tablets describe.
Wow. Big story to tell then, and here we are in Sandton, you know, richest part of Africa, but also one of the oldest parts here where, you know, civilization supposedly began. Lot to say, lot to explain. I wish you luck with it all. Tell me all the details of the book.
Right. The book being released in July 2008 is Adam's Calendar, and that deals with the calendar site found by Johann Heine in 2003. It took 5 years of research and development to get it to this point. Poo-pooed by many historians and archaeologists, by the way. Okay, but his persistence led us to discovering what we now believe is a key argument and a bit of evidence to deal with the earliest activity of the earliest humans found to date on Earth.
Do you have a website?
Yes, it will be on the Makumati website. Makumati is MAKOMATI, Makomati.
You had to think about
that. Yeah, I had to think about
that. What, makomati.co.za?
.co.za and .com, I believe, yes.
Okay, and if anybody wants to email you, can they do that from the site? Because I think you're probably going to get some response.
Yeah, email me. There's a link on the website, but it's also info@makomati.co.za or .com. I'm not sure right now because we're about to go live with the website. There are a few minor tweaks that we have to make.
I have to tell you, Michael, I wish you luck with all of this. I don't know whether You listening to this, wherever you may be, you just feel like I feel now, that I just want to take half an hour out to kind of stare at the sky and think about it all. That's how, I don't know, maybe that's how it leaves everybody, but that's certainly how it's left me. Michael Tellinger, thank you very much indeed. This is The Unexplained in Johannesburg, South Africa. My name is Howard Hughes. Thank you again to Graham Mullins, my webmaster, for all the hard work putting this out there to you. Thank you to you very much indeed for listening to this show and going on the website. You want to email me? That is easy. It's unexplainedhh@yahoo.co.uk. unexplainedhh@yahoo.co.uk. And if you're listening to this on iTunes or Feedburner, wherever you're listening to it, please put a hit on the website, which is, of course, www.theunexplained.tv. I'm back to London now, and I'll see you soon here on The Unexplained.